From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, a Wisconsin professor from Ukraine shares his experience since the full-scale invasion by Russia 2 years ago. Then we'll speak with a woman who helped organize and implement the first Earth Day.
The time was ripe to talk about the idea of celebrating the Earth and talking about the environment generally.
Plus, we'll speak with the director of Richland, a film that explores what remains of a small town built for the Manhattan Project.
To me, to really think about history, it's really important to think about kind of small everyday histories and all of the ways that those histories kind of overlap with each other or contradict each other.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. We'll start with the war in Ukraine and the history behind its conflict with Russia. Andrei Ivanov is a native of Ukraine and an associate professor of history at UW-Platteville. He joins WUWM's Chuck Quernbach to give some historical context and a look at what's happening in Ukraine more than 2 years since the full-scale invasion. He starts by describing how he found out about Russia's attack on Ukraine.
I was woken up really early in the morning when the war started in February of 2022 with my parents telling me that their area in Kyiv is under rocket attack and there's explosions that are heard everywhere. And from that moment on, I realized that the full-scale invasion has begun. Now, the war in Ukraine has continued actually since 2014. And this has been devastating to Ukrainian economy as well as Ukrainian people in general. But when the full-scale invasion had taken place, this turned my life catastrophically. I had to find ways to help relatives make it across the Polish border into Poland and then bring them to Wisconsin, helping my sister, my nieces, some other relatives, my parents as well, helping them to come here. It's been a long journey in a sense that, you know, the last 2 years feel like it's been already a long time. But the scale of humanitarian catastrophe that I have witnessed with a stream of Ukrainian refugees is really something that's unprecedented in Europe and hasn't been seen for decades.
Now, you were recently in Europe, close to Ukraine. Talk, if you will, a little bit about that experience and what you saw related to the conflict.
So I, in a span of 12 months, I traveled to Krakow, Poland, five times, which means I was in Krakow, Poland in March of 2022 when the war just started and you had the stream of refugees coming in. And then that was pretty much a year later again, when a lot of these refugees have started to settle down and some have returned back to Ukraine and some have left to Germany or left to other countries in Europe. So I've seen different stages of this humanitarian catastrophe and it's quite tragic. It's a tragedy. It is incredibly disheartening to see people who have been uprooted, lost everything, especially people from Mariupol, people from the Donbas, people from southern areas of Ukraine. I've worked with a lot with academics, and academics in Poland have been particularly proactive in reaching out and helping Ukrainian professors who have been displaced from this war. I've met professors from Mariupol. Now, what happens if you're a university professor and your university is destroyed? It's bombed out. It's just the shell of its former self. It was devastating. I've had many conversations, many talks. I've tried to help in many ways that I could. I've organized fundraisers and all kinds of things. But I think that the response that university professors in Krakow had taken to help fellow professors from Ukraine has been extremely proactive, extremely robust. And I'm thankful for all the help that European people and European academics have provided to Ukrainian refugees.
Well, have these professors who basically have lost their universities, if you will, have they gone on to teaching positions in other nations, or are they not being able to work in academia?
So the university in Krakow that I visited, Jagiellonian University, had provided different positions, temporary positions, to different academics that I met. However, Germany has been much more proactive in some ways because the Germans have more financial means for this, and they established special fellowships or scholarships, if you will, for the displaced scholars from Ukraine. And so there have been programs that were established in Germany, in UK, and other parts of Europe that are bringing displaced professors from Ukraine and giving them temporary positions of one type or another. Now, these positions are temporary, of course. Nobody knows when the war is going to end and how long could German academia and Polish academia sustain these guest professors who are staying in Poland and Germany and have nowhere to go.
I have met some people who have come to the U.S. from Ukraine. Has that been going on at all in the world of academia? Have any universities in the U.S. Helped provide employment to researchers, professors from Ukraine?
There has been efforts at Harvard. Harvard has reached out to the Davis Center and Harvard Ukrainian Institute. However, I think there's a lot more action here in Canada. Canadian universities have been more involved in bringing Ukrainian scholars here.
You spoke a few minutes ago about some people have gone back to Ukraine. In general, what are the factors as to whether refugees have gone back to Ukraine or stayed in one of the other countries?
Yes, it depends where they're from in Ukraine. If you're from the southern or southeastern part of Ukraine and your home has been destroyed and there's active war going on in those regions or regions that are close to the front lines, you're not going to come back. However, in the early months of the war, so February, March, April 2022, a lot of people from Western Ukraine, that is areas that are very close to Polish border or Hungarian border, had come to Europe because there was general panic and a lot of people were not sure what's going to happen to other areas of Ukraine. So there are areas in Ukraine that have been more or less stable. And this is true about Transcarpathia in particularly, and some areas close to Romania, known as Bukovina. There hasn't been as much rocket fire, as much aerial bombardment as in other parts of Ukraine. So people who have homes, people who have vineyards to take care of, people who have, you know, farms in near the Carpathian Mountains, they didn't see it problematic for them to return back to their homes. And many did, but many others cannot return to their homes because there are no homes to return to.
Well, you're a historian, obviously. Talk about the most relevant points, if you will, in Ukraine's history that might be motivating people to fight on, you know, 2+ years of a horrible war.
Yes. So Ukraine had many parts of its history, or there were events in its history that show Ukrainian struggle for freedom and embrace of freedom. So one is the Cossack uprising in 1648-1649, the first liberation war in Ukraine, when, you know, against all odds, the peasants of Ukraine had risen up for defense of their liberties and particularly for the religious freedom. You also have the moment of 1917-1918 when Ukrainians had declared independence and Ukraine became an independent nation, waiting for the recognition at the Peace of Versailles, at the Paris Peace Conference. Later, that didn't come through, but Ukrainian nation coalesced together, and you had actually different representatives. You had Jews, you had Poles, you had ethnic Russians, you had Tatars, you had other Nohai in Ukraine, Roma, Greeks, Germans, and other ethnic minorities kind of coalescing around this new idea that Ukrainian freedom is not just freedom for ethnic Ukrainians, it's freedom for everybody in Ukraine. And so liberty is not a zero-sum game. It's just something that, you know, if there's liberty for me, there's liberty for everybody. And so this was kind of a very important moment in the emergence and galvanization of Ukrainian democracy, the 1917-1918 period.
Professor, the words peace talks are often these days associated by some as a requirement for more military aid, that there should be peace talks. As a historian, what might be playing into some reluctance on the behalf of Ukraine for peace talks at this point?
Peace talks really, as a concept, historically involved the end of the conflict. And they have historically involved the idea that the contradictions and conflict, you know, the causes of the conflict will be fundamentally resolved, and a situation that created the conflict will be ameliorated. Now, this involves a resolute desire on both sides, that is Ukraine and Russia, to honor the nature of the peace talks. That is, the peace talks have to talk about a solution to war. It appears to me that for the Russian side, peace talks is a possible ploy to buy time, to build more missiles, to build new, more tanks. You know, 90% of Russia's new tanks have been obliterated in this war. Russia badly needs to rebuild its tank fleet, so to speak. So, you know, I see peace talks as, you know, when I hear the word peace talks, I think, wow, you know, this is something that's very encouraging, and I am for peace. However, peace talks should not be a method or a game just to buy more time to bring more and more destruction to Ukrainian people. Peace talks must be genuine. They must be for real.
Andrei Ivanov is a Ukrainian associate professor of history at UW-Platteville. He spoke with WUWM's Chuck Quernbach.
From Milwaukee's NPR, this is Capital Notes. We break down the big political news affecting Wisconsin. I'm Mayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross. He's editor of WisPolitics.com. He'll provide a roundup of the Wisconsin developments you need to know. Here's our latest conversation. Hi, J.R., good to talk to you.
No, thanks for having me.
So we'll start off with a way that politics is currently intersecting with people's health. It's PFAS, the forever chemical, is contaminating the groundwater in several Wisconsin communities, including Peshtigo, Wausau, and Green Bay. Last summer, the legislature approved millions of dollars to go towards cleanup, but so far, they've refused to distribute the money. What's happening here, JR?
Basically, Democratic Governor Tony Evers and Republican lawmakers can't agree on some provisions of the bill and the plan. And so this is a great example of what has become more frequent in the state capitol, where Republican lawmakers put money in the state budget to cover the cost of something, but they put the language to spend the money in a trailer bill. The reason they do that is governors have the authority in Wisconsin to use their partial veto authority if it's an appropriation bill. That means it spends money. If you put the spending in the bill with the language of how you want it spent, the governor can rewrite that language. They don't want that to happen. They want to control somewhat how this thing comes out. And they can't agree on what it should look like. I'll give you one example. One of the rubs is, or they call them, Republicans do, innocent landowners. Their argument is that these are people who did not create the PFAS pollution, didn't put it there. But if under what they want to do, they would be protected. You couldn't force them to pay for the cleanup because it wasn't their fault. The governor and his folks have argued that, wait a second, the way you're writing this, we think could protect polluters, people who may be more involved in what happened than they let on, for example. They don't like that. And so the governor vetoed the bill because of that and his argument that undercuts the authority of the Department of Natural Resources to regulate stuff. They just can't get on the same page. I mean, one, you know, you're talking Republicans and Democrats. They have different views of things. But two, this Republican legislature and this Democratic governor have not seen eye to eye on a lot of things the last 5 years. Here's another example of where they both want to do something. They can't agree on how to do it.
Well, with something as impactful as this, when we're talking about chemicals that are contaminating groundwater, affecting people's health, what do you see as the bridge here to get something done?
Excellent question, because here we are in mid-April. That budget was signed July of last year. They still can't agree at this point how to do it. Now, one of the things with PFAS is everybody knows that they're bad, right? Like, these are not good things. But there's a lack of urgency in, for some lawmakers and folks unless you have it in your backyard. I mean, this is a much bigger deal in a Peshtigo, in a Wausau, La Crosse, I believe, in Madison than it is other places that haven't dealt with this issue. So there isn't necessarily the same urgency. And two, again, they can't agree on how to get this thing done. And I don't know what the impact, how you're going to break the impasse. One thing that I've been reminded of is a couple of years ago, both the governor and the lawmakers want to do with a personal property tax. It's a property tax paid on equipment that businesses have. They both agreed they wanted to do it. They put money aside in the budget to pay local governments, the backfill, we call it, the lost revenue from that property tax going away. They couldn't agree in the final language. It took them until the next budget, 2 years later, to bring that money back around again and figure out the language of how to get rid of that tax to do it. It might be a repeat, what we're going to see here with PFAS, where it might take until next session for them to figure out how to get this thing done, because legislature's adjourned. They're not coming back. We don't expect them to, at least. And the governor keeps saying, release the money, because the money is at the Joint Finance Committee, the Budget Committee. They have the power to release it. The governor keeps saying, release the money so I can go spend it. Republicans keep going, not unless we have a plan that we agree on, because we don't trust you to spend it without some guardrails. I don't see how they get out of that right now unless there's some big breakthrough in the coming months.
All right. Well, moving from voters concerned about groundwater to voters and politicians concerned with how to vote, there are oral arguments on the attempt to bring back more absentee ballot drop boxes in the state Supreme Court next month. The case is in front of the state Supreme Court next month. Democratic Governor Tony Evers has intervened. What's this all about?
So essentially, the state Supreme Court in 2022, when there was a conservative majority, said state law in Wisconsin is not expressly authorized drop boxes. It was essentially was silent about it. There was nothing that said you couldn't use them, but nothing said that you could. The court ruled because of that there is you can't use a drop box in Wisconsin for an absentee ballot. You have to return it to the clerk via the mail or in person. Now, there's other issues for people who have disabilities that was hammered out in a federal court case, but let's focus just on the drop boxes piece. So that case was 2022. 2023, Janet Protasiewicz wins a spot in the state Supreme Court. Flips majority from 4-3 conservative to 4-3 liberal. Now there's a new lawsuit basically seeking to reverse that 2022 decision to allow drop boxes again. Why is it coming up? Because we have a presidential race coming up in Wisconsin in November. We are going to be one of the 4, 5, 6 states that decide the presidency. And there are people who are going, look, the Elections Commission is hopelessly deadlocked most time at 3-3 on various election laws. Our best path is the courts to try and get some stuff done, especially with the liberal majority. If you're a Democrat, they see a friendlier hearing, a friendlier group of people to hear their arguments than they might have had at the old majority. Here we are back with this similar case, similar issue. Can use a drop box in Wisconsin. It's telegraphed, obviously, that because the court took this case, that there are at least some liberals in the court that want to reverse that 2022 decision. That shouldn't be a shock to anybody. Unless you're open to it, you wouldn't take the case in the first place, right? So it's one of several we're watching right now that could dictate election law policy in Wisconsin this fall, and one of a number of lawsuits that deal with absentee balloting. For example, new lawsuit filed last week dealing with those who are disabled, arguing that there should be a way for them to cast an absentee ballot electronically. Wisconsin used to allow that for people pre-2011. Republicans took control of the legislature, the governor's office, restrict that just to overseas, permanent overseas voters and military voters. There was a challenge to that restriction in general. Went through the federal courts, wasn't successful. Now they're back focusing on the narrow question of should you allow those with disabilities to vote absentee electronically, via email, essentially. The argument is if you don't allow this, then you have people who have disabilities who their right to privacy is compromised. When you go in the ballot booth, right, most people, cast your ballot, nobody's looking over your shoulder. The argument is that people with disabilities, some of them, can't cast that ballot on their own if they have to, you know, do it in person. Electronically, though, they could do it, and that would protect that right to privacy.
Well, NPR has reported about how voting online is actually very, very risky. I mean, there's a small amount of people that are able to do it in the United States. Election expert said that putting a server online to support online ballot return is like asking a kid to go play in traffic. It just isn't safe.
Wait, that was bad advice from my parents when I was a kid? What are you talking about? You're absolutely, it's a very fair point. I mean, but this is sort of the challenge that certain people face in casting ballots. How do you address, right, their concerns? It's an interesting issue for the courts and one that could shape how this race is run or administered this fall.
Well, back to the drop boxes. In 2020, I'll just talk about the city of Milwaukee. There were 15 locations in the city with actual 24-hour drop boxes, and that was the height of the pandemic. You know, obviously, we're in a different place right now. It's 2024. The pandemic has receded. What kind of role do you think drop boxes could play, even if they do come back?
Not as prominent as one as 2020. I mean, we've seen the trend line from the pandemic to now where people are voting absentee less. They're going back more to quote-unquote their normal method of voting. Now, it's still elevated. People have found out that, hey, I kind of like this convenience of voting absentee. It's kind of nice. But for the most part, it's not what was going to be like in 2020. I think it was, 2 million votes were cast absentee in 2020 out of 3.3 million cast. We're likely not going to see that again in Wisconsin this fall. But again, I've covered presidential races since 2000 in Wisconsin. Other than having Barack Obama on the ballot, not a single one's been decided by more than 23,000 votes. Like every single ballot counts in Wisconsin. That's not even an exaggeration at all. So how they're cast, if they're cast properly, what the courts say, they're all going to play roles this fall and possibly deciding who the president is.
And of course, at least 29 other states are currently allowing for absentee ballot drop boxes in locations other than election offices. So this isn't like an unheard of thing. It's why was there the partisan resistance? I mean, I know that President Trump was making false claims that drop boxes contributed to voter fraud, but is that basically what it's all about?
Well, for Republicans, they put a kind of a policy statement in state law some years ago that said voting absentee is a privilege. Because it is a privilege, it deserves to adhere to strict standards to ensure there's no fraud. And the worry is among a lot of Republicans is that absentee ballot is more prone to being vulnerable to fraud than voting in person is. So they worry that when you don't have a strict standard that things could go awry. That's not just because of Trump. It's kind of been there before. But Trump has elevated that argument. And he seized upon what happened in 2020 to try and claim that the election was stolen from him in Wisconsin. We know from the review by the nonpartisan Legislative Audit Bureau. We know from the review done by the Conservative Wisconsin for Law and Liberty. There is no evidence of widespread fraud in Wisconsin in 2020. But Trump and those who back him most vocally refuse to accept he lost the state of Wisconsin. They just keep arguing there was fraud somehow, though we've not seen any evidence of it. And that's long as you have an avenue to claim that there was some kind of something awry with absentee balloting, you run that risk of what happens in 2024, hearing the same kind of arguments post-election.
But drop boxes really weren't a partisan issue necessarily before 2020.
People really hadn't, not really, they hadn't really seen it. Now, there were some partisan, there were concerns Republicans raised about, like in Madison, they had paid city clerk employees in parks collecting absentee ballots. There were concerns raised if that was appropriate. But yeah, I mean, we saw a letter from, if I remember correctly, from then Senate Leader Scott Fitzgerald and then Assembly Speaker Robin Voss that talked about drop boxes. We weren't saying, hey, we want them eliminated, but was talking about the use of them. So there wasn't that same level of concern, but that's a long time ago now, it seems like, right?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely seems like a long time ago. All right. Well, thanks for this background, JR. It's real helpful. And thanks for joining me on Capitol Notes.
Anytime.
That was WUWM's Mayan Silver speaking with JR Ross of WIS Politics. You can hear Capitol Notes every other Monday on Lake Effect. And WUWM has a new politics podcast called Swing State of the Union. It explores why Wisconsin is a deeply purple state and why Wisconsin is so important in this election year. You can find a trailer at WUWM.com. The first episode will drop next Wednesday, and you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about a small town and its complicated history with how the atomic bombs were developed. But first, we'll hear from the only woman who was part of a group of people who helped make the first Earth Day happen. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Today is Earth Day. In the late 1960s, there was a groundswell of environmental activism, as waterways were polluted and the air was unhealthy to breathe. Even the nation's symbol, the bald eagle, faced extinction. So in 1970, former Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson established Earth Day. But there were lots of people involved in creating the day that celebrates the Earth and invites others to think about the environment. One of them was Barbara Alexander. She was on a team of five people who coordinated the first Earth Day. Here she is speaking with WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Benz about how it all happened.
Well, I was in Washington, D.C. I had worked as a volunteer, a very young volunteer, in the Robert F. Kennedy campaign. I was part of a group who were hauled across the country from Indiana to Oregon to California to organize events and organize house-to-house canvassing, which was a new thing at that time for elections. After that horrendous summer of 68, I went to D.C. and I ended up working at the Conservation Foundation, which is a fancy, fairly wealthy nonprofit who had done a lot in the conservation field and was starting to hire some people to talk about the environment, the urban environment, the pollution environment, and not just conservation of wildlife as such. And when it was decided that a group would be formed to actually organize an Earth Day event, the people who were hired first, Dennis Hayes, Steve Cotton, Andy Garling, then took ideas from others in the DC area. And my name popped up and I walked right over. So
that would have been 1969?
Yes,
yeah.
It was.
Wow. So talk about that brainstorming. What was in the air then?
Well, the 1969 was a time of public angst about the war. And a lot of young people were getting involved in policy and public policy. And we were the coming of age generation who took upon ourselves to tell the old folks what should be done and how to do it. Right? Just like the young ones today are doing to us. But anyway, the environmental movement was on the cusp of having a breakout in terms of public involvement. The pollution in the air and water was absolutely horrendous. And so there were beginning to be rumblings about the need for more national pollution control and more national action. And so the time was ripe to talk about the idea of celebrating the Earth and talking about the environment generally. So the first thing this office did was form its own organizational structure, its own fundraising, and we changed our name to Environmental Action and organized in the sense that we rode the wave of the idea of Earth Day, which took off like wildfire.
So, Barbara, was Gaylord Nelson on the scene, meaning were you interacting with him over that time or you were going for it?
I had no interaction with him or his office, but I'm quite sure that the initial hirees, Dennis Hayes and others, certainly communicated with him and his office But I have to say that the entire organizational approach, our PR, our fundraising was all done independently of that in pretty short order.
Had to be exciting times, I would think, feeling that you're really making something happen.
Well, you know, part of the way in which this happened is something that is totally unlike the current social media scene. This was a time in which the national press really was the national press. At the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Baltimore Sun, you know, and the CBS, NBC, ABC, national networks. And when they took on this issue of talking about Earth Day, promoting the stories about Earth Day, doing research and writing about the environment and what was going on with pollution, air and water in particular, that just spread like wildfire because that was the only way that the national news was circulated. So Walter Cronkite and ABC and CBS all had national press assigned to this story pretty early on. Of course, the college groups and the citywide organizations of Earth Day activities was carefully coordinated and promoted by our office. But the expansive activities by grade school kids and high school kids and many college groups just happens. And all we did was gather information and report it, frankly, on little note cards. We had the phone number of all these activists. And that made a big difference for the next phase after Earth Day.
Well, let's talk about the next phase.
Well, after Earth Day, a number of the staffers went on to other things in their life. Not me. I was hot to trot. I really wanted to get involved in the legislative side of this, to actually implement changes to the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And Nader's office, Citizen Action, was doing a lot of research and writing on both those things at that time and identifying all the defects in the current federal law. And we had Senator Ed Muskie, who was the head of the Senate committee, in charge of writing both those laws. So the combination was an incredible opportunity. We got out in front. I helped organize a coalition of traditional conservation organizations, all the new environmental groups, and the unions, the League of Women Voters, which was very active, UAW, steelworkers, oil, chemical, and atomic workers. All of these organizations supported very stringent federal law to reduce pollution out of factories and cars into the air and the water. And that opportunity used all the excitement about Earth Day to make a political event that the industry really could not, was not yet organized in the grassroots way we were, because we had all those telephone numbers. We had contacts with all those local organizations. And believe me, they lobbied like crazy and had a significant impact on the entire political process at that time. So everything came together in a very, very serendipitous way. But that was what I did for several years after Earth Day.
So how long would you say that wave, the movement rode that way, the work of making environmental policy a reality? How long did that surge?
Oh, well, that surged quite a bit because it was during this era that the Environmental Protection Agency was formed. Even Nixon got on board with a lot of this reform, and the Republicans and some of the more conservative Democrats just got rode right over. The Clean Water Act, a couple years after the Clean Air Act, was an example of that. So it was a very interesting time and a very positive time for progress that you could actually point to. If I show people today what the Potomac looked like, what the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland looked like, what the air pollution over our major cities looked like or smelled like, and the really incredible progress in clean air and water we've enjoyed in this country, I can feel very comfortable saying that we won that fight big time. So it was good.
Do you see any possibility that the kind of energies, talent, and those various forces, or the forces of today, might come together to push for policy that would push back on climate change?
Well, there's a couple real differences between the debates we were having then. One is the way social media has allowed misinformation and downright conspiracy theories to really confuse a lot of people and lead them in directions of lack of understanding and lack of commitment to an issue like this. But I tell you, the really big issue here is that climate change is not going to get solved by a law directing a factory to do something different. The reforms that are being promoted here demand that people do something with their own money to invest in something that they may or may not be able to afford or think it's their responsibility. If you want to clean up transportation, we can make the buses run clean, but unless people buy electric vehicles and feel they have a stake in the value of doing that, that's a very different proposition than passing a law to tell a competitive business that it has to include the cost of pollution control in its products and services. So dealing with people's wants and fears and desires about how they want to spend their own money is something that I don't think the movement has really come to grips with.
Barbara Alexander was one of the organizers behind the first Earth Day. She was the only woman on the team, and she spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Benz. You'll hear more Earth Week stories this week on Lake Effect, including a story on how kids can get involved in birding. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, but ahead of that, we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Then listen for new episodes starting in May, on Thursdays during Lake Effect and Fridays during Morning Edition. Coming up, we'll speak with the director of Richland, a film that explores what was left behind in a small town created during the Manhattan Project, and how the people living there today acknowledge that history. That's next on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Last year, the film Oppenheimer captivated millions, but that was the Hollywood version of the atom bomb's history. A new documentary takes a step back and offers a more complex look. During the Manhattan Project, the U.S. government built a small town in support of the Hanford nuclear site, where workers manufactured weapons-grade plutonium. It's a history that has shaped Richland's identity. In her film, director Irene Lustig explores what it means for a town to take pride in such a violent heritage and how residents are grappling with this legacy now. Ahead of Richland's screening at the Milwaukee Film Festival, Lustig speaks with WUWM's Lena Tran.
How did your work start on this project? What drew you to Richland's story?
Yeah, you know, I actually learned about Richland in a pretty roundabout and not intentional way. I was working between maybe 2015 and 2017. I was shooting this totally different film called Yours in Sisterhood, where I was doing these really massive road trips all over the US. And that film was based on letters that had been sent to Ms. Magazine in the 70s. So totally different topic. But I was basically finding letters and traveling to the communities where letters had been sent from in the 70s. And So I pretty accidentally had found a letter that was sent from Richland in the 70s to Ms. and then ended up in Richland for 24 hours and did some shooting there. And yeah, I think just got really kind of obsessed just from the one pretty short visit. I hadn't heard about Hanford. And it's interesting, as I've screened the film around the country, I find that people in the Pacific Northwest may have heard of Hanford, and then it's quite invisible still to the rest of the country. Which is interesting. Like Los Alamos is a site that people know much better. And Richland was much, Hanford was much larger. It was 600 square miles. It was really the largest kind of scaled up production site of the Manhattan Project, but it's pretty off people's radars still. And yeah, I think I just became so, you know, initially so curious and interested about what it meant for a community to have this kind of such a visible kind of nuclear weapon as a heritage symbol. But then also in that moment of like 2015, 2016, when I first went there, as the Trump election was happening, as all of these new forms of kind of US conservatism were becoming more and more visible, I think I just had a kind of intuition that in this community, it could be a place where I could think through kind of much bigger questions of how we live with our histories, what we look at, what we turn away from. So kind of all of the bigger questions of the films were things I was thinking about in that time.
But that complexity became pretty apparent to you from that first day you spent there?
In the town, yes, because really there's a way, anyone who comes into the town, there's this just kind of incredibly visible layer of kind of just visual nuclear heritage where there's, you know, restaurants and bowling alleys. And as you see in the film, kind of street names, like it's really everywhere visually in the town. So it's, yeah, I think it really felt like just a big question kind of hanging over the town of what is this relationship to history? What does it mean? What does it mean to value and cherish these really kind of violent symbols? The complexity, I think, felt really kind of on the surface to me right away.
Yeah. That being said, there aren't really easy answers in Richland. Like, did America do the right thing or the wrong thing? Or did the government mistreat the people who worked for the government? Or did they have good family supporting jobs? You know, why was that tone important to you?
Yeah, you know, there's not, I have actually watched a lot of nuclear films as I researched this film and as I was working on it. And I will say there's actually, I feel there's very few nuclear films that are not advocacy films that are taking a really clear stance that's either pro-nuclear or anti-nuclear. And I think it's an issue where actually it produces such a divisive politics that it's actually hard to like hold a conversation at all where there's kind of complexity and recognition of what different people are holding kind of around their own experiences and lives in nuclear communities. So yeah, I think I knew from the beginning that I was not interested in making a kind of position film. But really my questions were, and I always start with questions, but I think I really wanted to think pretty deeply about what are the structural forces that are shaping conservative politics. And to me, a lot of the answers to that are in this kind of complexity of how do you reckon with work that's good work, that puts food on the table, that supports your family, and then what's the kind of storytelling you need to do to not feel horrible about your life and what you do for a living. So whether that's kind of attaching to really like patriotic national narratives, whether that's attaching to a kind of conservative set of national discourses or policies, whether that's just, you know, not wanting to think about nuclear harm either within your own community or to Japanese communities or indigenous communities or downwinder communities. I think to me, what I was really interested in was that question of what is the structure of that? And then how does that shape our politics? And that's a different starting point, I think, from kind of starting with, you know, nuclear weapons are horrible and have caused harm, or nuclear energy is great and is going to solve our, you know, energy transition crisis.
It's almost more challenging because it's like, oh, I'm used to engaging with nuclear stories where there is a clear position. And I'm thinking about this in a big election year again. You know, you mentioned that this project kind of started in a big election season. And maybe there is like a desire or need to understand people and perspectives that maybe differ from our own. What did you learn about having those difficult conversations?
Yeah, I mean, that was the whole project for me, honestly. Like, I really wanted to actually challenge myself to do that kind of listening that's generous, that's not judgmental, that's kind of making space for holding people's positions with complexity, to like letting people talk for long enough that you actually understand their position in a complicated way rather than like reducing them to a simple position, which I think is often what can happen in a more kind of advocacy oriented sort of talking heads documentary, is people just appear briefly to like represent a position, but they're not kind of holding all the complexity of who they are and what's shaped their opinions. But yeah, I think that work feels politically urgent to me. And that was what I wanted to do, actually, was to kind of give myself the challenge of what would it feel like to really spend time, to build relationships, to listen generously. And yeah, I found it very transformative to do that. And I think it's important. It's important work to even and then push through moments where it feels uncomfortable, or you just hear something that you want to reject or you really don't agree with. But then what can happen if you just stay in the conversation and let it unfold more and just try to hear where that person is coming from? And it's small scale work, but I really feel it's urgent political work that a lot of us should be doing now.
Yeah. What comes to mind is the scene in the donut shop where you're talking to the two men. And one man, the older man on the left, is like super open and talks to you right away. And the one on the right is like, seems a little bit more aware of the camera. And he's like, I don't really feel like saying anything yet. But you sit there long enough. And then he opens up and then shares this song that is amazing. And so that is such a good example of what kind of moment arrives when you wait for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think of that scene also as one where you just really feel this kind of, you know, violence and lyricism kind of entangled together, where, yeah, the first man who's more open kind of, you know, tells a racist joke about bombing the Japanese, sings a war song that's kind of uncomfortable. So I think there's a kind of initial, for a lot of viewers, kind of push away kind of feeling from that scene, from those men. But then you kind of sit with it, and yeah, like the manner, there's poetry and there's lyricism, and they talk about loving their home, and kind of something else happens that's more complicated. And I think it, yeah, you're right that it does happen because you're there for long enough that all of that stuff can be in the space.
Well, so you use art in really powerful ways in this film. There's these songs, the chorus, poetry readings. I loved the music performance with the two women. And then, of course, there's this really ghostly, beautiful sculpture from the Japanese artist. Do you feel like you were making a case that art is necessary for navigating these histories? Or did you feel like the community was already doing that and then you're just chronicling it?
I think it was both. And actually, whether, you know, the choral piece was already happening in the community and then other things happened because I instigated them or kind of created collaborative spaces. But yeah, absolutely. I think there's something very powerful. And I think about this a lot, even in terms of my own work as a filmmaker, kind of what is it that a film can do or hold that's different from, you know, what a journalist can do with writing or what you might put in a scholarly book. And I think film is really something that can hold feelings and hold things that exceed language or maybe are things that are hard to articulate verbally, like what it feels like to be somewhere or what someone's face and body language looks like while they're speaking. I think there's all of this kind of subtext and other information that's a little bit beyond what we can articulate consciously. And I think that's why I work in film, is because it can hold all of this other stuff that's not just information. And yeah, I think in the community and with processing these things that are difficult histories, I do feel like art can kind of hold community feelings in a way that's, yeah, way beyond what people might be able to talk about in an interview, but that's really deep and complicated.
Well, it's hard to ignore that your film released when the country was totally swept up in like Barbenheimer fever. Was that just like lucky press for you?
Mm-hmm. It was lucky press for me. Yeah, and it's been interesting. Yeah, of course, I had to go see Oppenheimer for research, and people have asked me about it a lot at screenings. I didn't know it was coming out. And of course, it's interesting to think across the two films. They're really, yeah, not only different in scale and budget, but I think also in kind of investments and approach and method. They're pretty different.
Well, what do you hope Richland adds to the conversation?
Yeah, you know, a lot, actually. I think Oppenheimer, you know, like a lot of Hollywood films, it's a kind of way of thinking about history that's through, you know, like one great white man who shaped history. And I think as someone who identifies as a feminist maker, I'm always also interested in thinking about history, but in a much more kind of networked and relational and complicated way, where history is never made by one great man, but it's something that happens across so many different spaces and stakeholders and impacts so many different people in different ways. And like, to me, to really think about history, it's about really important to think about kind of small everyday histories and all of the ways that those histories kind of overlap with each other or contradict each other. Yeah, I think it's just a really different set of methods. But then in that different set of methods, I think it's really important to you know, hold those stories of what happened with Indigenous land dispossession when all of the Manhattan Project sites were built, what happened with downwinders in the community when nuclear weapons were, you know, detonated on U.S. land, what happened in Japan. I think it's really, yeah, just important to think expansively about who's affected by history. Mm-hmm. And I think Oppenheimer, that's just not its project to really sure. touch on all of those different spaces, but a lot of that is left out of the film.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Irene, for joining me on Lake Effect. It was really a pleasure to learn more about the film. I hope that Milwaukee viewers who are excited to see Oppenheimer will show up for Richland.
Thank you so much.
Irene Lustig is the director of the film Richland. She spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran. Milwaukee Film is a financial contributor to WUWM. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, you can download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. It's Lesbian Visibility Week, and tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about some of the women in Wisconsin history who fought for LGBTQ rights. That's tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.